Chapter 45. Pitt and Giardino discreetly left the American Embassy through the lobby of the passport office, stepped out onto the street, and hailed a taxi. Pitt gave the driver directions written down in French by an embassy aide and settled back as the taxi wove through the main square past the city's picturesque mosques with their towering minarets. Their luck of the draw was a hyper-driver who constantly honked and cursed the crowds of pedestrians and heavy auto traffic that flowed blissfully through stoplights and past policemen who showed little interest in controlling the mess. At the main thoroughfare that paralleled the busy waterfront, the driver swung south and drove to the city's outskirts, where he stopped in a winding alley as instructed. Pitt paid him off and waited until the taxi turned out of sight. In less than a minute, a French Air Force staff car pulled up, a 605 Peugeot diesel sedan. They climbed into the back seat without any acknowledgment from the uniformed driver, who accelerated down the alley before Giardino closed the rear door. 10 kilometers later, the car stopped at the main gate of a military airfield, flying the tricolor over the sentry house. The security guard took one look at the Peugeot and nodded it through as he threw a sharp French salute with the palm facing outward. At the entrance to the tarmac, the driver stopped and inserted the staff of a checkered flag into a socket mounted on the left front fender. "Don't tell me," said Giardino. "I'm keen to guess. We're the Grand Marshals in a parade." Pitt laughed. "Have you forgotten your Air Force days? Any vehicle that drives across the flight line has to fly an authorization flag." The Peugeot rolled by a long row of Mirage 2000 Delta Wing fighters being serviced by their ground crews. One end of the flight line held a squadron of AS-332 Super Puma helicopters that looked as if they were designed by a myopic Buck Rogers. Built to carry air-to-surface missiles, they did not have the killer look of most other attack helicopters. The driver continued to the deserted end of a secondary runway and parked. They sat there waiting, Giardino promptly dozing off under the comfort of the staff car's air conditioning, while Pitt casually read an embassy copy of the Wall Street Journal. 15 minutes later, a big Airbus silently banked out of the west and touched down. Neither Pitt nor Giardino was aware of the aircraft's approach until they heard the screech of its tires hitting the concrete runway. Giardino came awake, and Pitt folded up his paper as the plane braked and then slowly turned on one wheel until it had rotated 180 degrees. As soon as the huge tires rolled to a stop, the driver of the Peugeot shifted in gear and drove up within 5 meters of the rear of the aircraft. Pitt observed that the entire Airbus was painted a light desert tan, and he noted the indistinguishable markings on its surfaces that had been painted over. A woman wearing desert combat fatigues with a patch on one sleeve, signifying the UN world symbol with a sword through it, dropped from a hatch in the aircraft's belly between the huge landing gear. She double-timed over to the staff car and opened the rear door. "Please do follow me," she said in English, heavily coated with Spanish. As the car drove away, the UN tactical team member led them under the bulbous fuselage and gestured for them to climb inside. They entered the lower cargo bay of the Airbus and stepped toward a narrow stairwell that rose to the main cabin. Giardino paused and glanced at 3 armored personnel carriers that sat in a row, squat and low, topping out at less than 2 meters. Then he stared in rapt fascination at the heavily armed dune buggy used in the rescue of Gunn at Gao. "Enter an off-road race with this thing," he said admiringly, "and no competitor would dare pass you."
"It does look pretty intimidating," Pitt agreed.
An officer was waiting for them when they surfaced in the main cabin.
"Captain Pembroke Smythe," he introduced himself. "Jolly good of you to come. Colonel Avant is waiting for you in the planning room."
"You're obviously English," said Giardino.
"Yes, you'll find us a rather mixed lot," Pembroke Smythe said cheerfully as he swung the end of a swagger stick around the cabin at 3 dozen men and 3 women engaged in various stages of cleaning and assembling weapons and equipment. "Some creative soul thought the UN should have its own tactical unit to go where international governments fear to tread, so to speak. Secret warriors, we are sometimes called, each highly trained by his own country's special forces. All volunteers. Some are permanent, a few of us are simply attached on a year's tour of duty."
They were as tough and rugged a group as Pitt had ever seen. Bodies hardened through exercise and brutal training, they were quiet, purposeful professionals with all the skills and intelligence demanded by covert actions.
There wasn't one that Pitt cared to meet in a dark alley, including the women. Pembroke Smythe ushered them into a compartment that was the command center of the aircraft. The area was spacious and filled with an array of electronic systems. One operator monitored communications equipment while another was in the act of programming data for the approaching mission to Tabeza into a computer. Colonel Levant graciously came from behind a desk and greeted Pitt and Giordino at the door. He wasn't sure what to expect. He had read extensive dossiers on both men, supplied by the United Nations International Intelligence Service, and could not help but be impressed with their accomplishments. He also read a brief report of their trials in the desert after escaping to Beza and had to admire their tenacity. Levant had previously expressed deep reservations about taking Pitt and Giordino along, but quickly realized that without their guidance into the mines, the operation could be in deep jeopardy. They appeared gaunt and showed the results of long exposure to the sun, but seemed in amazingly good condition as he shook their hands. "After studying your exploits, gentlemen, I've looked forward to meeting you. I am Colonel Marcel Levant, Dirk Pitt, and my nasty little friend here is Al Giordino. After reading a report of your ordeal, I expected you to be carried on board on stretchers, but I'm pleased to see you look quite fit." "Liquids, vitamins, and plenty of exercise," said Pitt, smiling, "have their benefits." "Don't forget fun in the sun," muttered Giordino. Levant did not respond to the humor, but stared past them at Pembroke Smythe. "Captain, please alert the men and order the chief pilot to prepare for immediate takeoff." Then he turned his attention back to the men standing before him. "If what you say is correct, time is measured in lives. We can run over details for the mission while we're in the air." Pitt nodded in total accord. "I applaud your expediency." Levant checked his watch. "Flying time is slightly more than 4 hours. Our time window is very narrow. We can't delay if we intend to make our assault during the prisoner's rest period. Too soon or too late, and they will be scattered throughout the mine shafts on work crews, and we'd never find and round them up before our scheduled withdrawal. 4 hours will put us over to Beza at night. 2000 hours, give or take 5 minutes. "You're going in with landing lights?" asked Pitt incredulously. "You might as well add fireworks to let them know we're coming." Levant twisted one end of his mustache, a gesture Pitt was to see often in the next 10 hours. "We land in the dark, and before I explain, I think you should sit down and fasten your seat belts." His words were enforced with the strangely muted roar of the engines as the pilot advanced the throttles. The big Airbus began accelerating down the runway with only the slightest rumble of thrust from its engines. Giordino found Levant a bit too stuffy and arrogant for his taste and acted with polite indifference. Pitt, on the other hand, recognized a savvy and street-smart operator when he saw one. He also sensed a subtle undercurrent of respect from the colonel that Giordino missed. During liftoff, Pitt remarked about the unusual silence of the engines. The typical roar was not evident for an aircraft under full power. "Specially modified silencers for the turbine exhaust," explained Levant. "They work well," said Pitt admiringly. "When you landed, I didn't hear a thing until the tires touched down." "You might call it a stealth factor for covert landings in places we're not welcome." "Do you also sneak in without lights?" Levant nodded. "Without lights." "Is your pilot equipped with fancy high-tech night vision equipment?" "No, Mr. Pitt, nothing fancy. 4 of my men drop by parachute on the Tabeza airstrip, secure it, and then place a series of infrared lights to guide our pilot onto the runway." "Once down," said Pitt, "covering the ground between the airstrip and mine entrance in the black of night won't be an easy chore." "That," said Levant grimly, "is the least of our problems." The plane was in a gradual climb and banking to the south when he unfastened his seat belt and stepped to a table with an enlarged satellite photo of the plateau above the mines. He picked up a pencil and tapped on the photo. "Landing helicopters onto the plateau and rappelling down the canyon walls to the mine entrance would have greatly simplified our problem and given us a higher level of surprise. Unfortunately, there were other considerations." "I understand your dilemma," said Pitt. "A round trip to Tabeza is beyond helicopter range. Setting up fuel depots across the desert would have caused additional delay." 32 hours, according to our estimates. We considered leapfrogging our small copter squadron, one carrying fuel while the other carried men and supplies, but we ran into complications with that plan, too.
Too complicated and too slow, said Giordino.
The speed factor also favored the use of this aircraft, said Levant.
Another important factor of using an airliner over a fleet of helicopters is that we carry our own transportation.
We also have space for onboard medical facilities to tend the large number of people you stated in your report that are in dire need of attention.
How many make up your assault team? Asked Pitt.
38 fighters and 2 medics, Levant answered.
After we land, 4 will remain to guard the plane. The medical team will accompany the main force to care for the captives.
That doesn't leave much room in your personnel carriers to transport everyone.
If some of my people ride on the roofs and hang on to the sides, we can evacuate 40 prisoners.
There may not be that many left alive, Pitt said solemnly.
We'll do our best for those who are, Levant assured him.
And the Malians, Pitt asked, the political dissenters and enemies of General Kazim, what about them?
They will have to remain, Levant shrugged. All food stores in the mines will be opened to them, and they'll be armed with the guards' weapons. Beyond that, there is little we can do for them. They will be on their own.
Kazim is sadistic enough to demand their mass execution after he's learned his prize slaves have flown the coop.
I have my orders, Levant stated simply, and they don't include saving local criminals.
Pitt stared down at the blow-up of the desert surrounding the Tabeza Plateau.
So you intend to land the Airbus in the dead of night on a desert airstrip, drive over a road that's tough to trace in daylight, assault the mine, carry off all foreign prisoners, and then rush back to the strip and take off for the lights of Algiers.
We may be biting off more than we can chew with the limited resources at your command.
Levant saw no disapproval in Pitt's expression, nor did he sense sarcastic criticism.
As you say where you come from, Mr. Pitt, what you see is what you get.
I'm not doubting the fighting quality of your people, Colonel, but I had expected a larger, better-equipped force.
I regret the UN does not lavishly fund our response and tactical team with expansive manpower and ultra-sophisticated equipment like most special operations forces. But our budget is tight, and we must work within our limits.
Why a Unocrat team? Asked Pitt curiously.
Why not a British or French Foreign Legion commando unit, or one from American Special Forces?
Because no other nation, including yours, wished to risk dirtying their hands on this mission, explained Levant wearily.
We were volunteered by Secretary General Camille.
The name brought back a fond memory in Pitt's mind of an interlude spent with Hala Camille on board a ship in the Straits of Magellan. 2 years ago, he recalled, during the search for the Alexandria Library treasures.
Levant caught the faraway look, and Giordino knowingly smiled.
Pitt saw their expressions and refocused his attention to the satellite map.
There is a catch.
There are several, said Levant evenly, but they can all be overcome.
Except 2.
And they are?
We don't know where O'Banion's communication center and security monitoring rooms are located. If he sends out an alert to Kazim's security forces before you can stop him, we won't stand a bishop's chance in hell of making it back to this aircraft and getting a good head start to Algeria before one of his fighter squadrons shows up and nails us to the nearest barn door.
In that case, we have to get in and out of the mine within 40 minutes, said Levant.
Not impossible if most of the captives can make it above ground without help.
If many of them have to be carried, we will lose valuable time we cannot spare.
At that moment, Captain Pembroke Smythe appeared with a tray of coffee and sandwiches from the aircraft's galley.
"Our fare is filling, if not gourmet," he said cheerfully. "You have a choice between chicken salad and tuna fish."
Pitt looked at Levant and grinned.
"You weren't kidding when you said you ran on a tight budget."
As the Airbus soared over the desert as black as the sea, Pitt and Giordino sketched large diagrams of the mine levels as they remembered them. Levant was amazed at their recollections. Neither professed to photographic memories, but they recalled an enormous amount of detail for the short time they were held prisoner in the mine. Levant and 2 other officers interrogated the Numa men in depth, often repeating questions 3 or 4 times in hopes of obtaining details observed but overlooked.
The track to the canyon, the layout of the mine, the weapons of the guards, it was all covered over and over. The data was voice-recorded on computer, and the sketches of the mine programmed into three dimensions. Nothing was overlooked. The weather forecast for the next several hours, the flight time of Kazim's jet fighters from Gao, alternate escape plans and routes should the Airbus be destroyed on the ground. Every possible contingency was given a plan. An hour before touchdown at Tabeza, Levant assembled his small force of men and women in the main cabin. Pitt led off the briefing by describing the guards, their numbers and arms, and observations of their indolent attitude from living and working beneath the desert. He was followed by Giordino, who gave them a tour of the mine levels with the oversized sketches pinned to a standing easel. Pembroke Smythe divided up the UN tactical team that was to execute the assault into four units and passed out individual maps of the underground tunnels printed from the computer. Levant capped the briefing by instructing the teams on their missions. "I apologize for our lack of intelligence," he began. "We've never attempted such a dangerous mission with so little data. The charts you've been given of the mine show probably less than 20% of the existing tunnels and shafts. We have to strike hard and fast by securing the offices and guards' quarters. Once we've eliminated resistance, we will round up the prisoners and begin our withdrawal. Final rendezvous will be at the entrance cavern exactly 40 minutes from the time we go in. Any questions so far?" A hand went up, and a man near the front spoke up with a Slavic accent. "Why 40 minutes, Colonel?" "Any more, Corporal Wadlinski, and a Malian fighter pilot at the nearest Air Force base can close and shoot us down before we're safely back into Algeria. I'm hoping that most of the captives can make it to our transports without help. If many of them have to be carried, we will be delayed." Another hand. "What if we get lost in the mine and cannot find our way back to the rendezvous in time for the withdrawal?" "Then you will be left behind," Levant answered conversationally. "Anyone else?" "Do we get to keep any gold we find?" The query came from a muscle-bound character in the back, followed by a round of laughter. "You will all be strip-searched at the end of the mission," replied Pembroke Smythe jovially, "and any gold found will be turned over to my personal account in Switzerland." "The ladies, too?" This from one of the women. He threw her a wily smile. "Especially the ladies." Though it did not crack his serious expression, Levant was thankful for the show of humor to relax the tense atmosphere. "Now that we know where the booty goes," he said, "let us wrap this up. I will lead the first unit with Mr. Pitt as our guide. We will clear the offices on the upper level before descending into the mine and releasing the captives from their hellhole. Unit 2, under the command of Captain Pembroke Smythe and led by Mr. Giordino, will drop down the elevator and secure the guards' quarters. Lieutenant Steinholm will be in charge of Unit 3 and will follow as backup and take up defensive positions at the side shafts off the main tunnel to prevent flanking movements. Unit 4 under Lieutenant Morrison will secure the gold ore recovery levels. Except for the medical team, the rest of you will remain to guard the airstrip. Any further questions shall be directed to your unit commanders." Levant paused and stared around the interior of the cabin at the faces of his men. "I regret we've had so little time to prepare for this operation, but it should not prove beyond the capabilities of a team that has successfully accomplished its last 6 missions without the loss of a single man or woman. If you should confront the unexpected, improvise. We have to get in, free the captives, and get out fast before we are pursued by the Malian Air Force. End of speech. Good luck to all of you." Then Levant turned and walked into his command compartment.